the National Defense Authorization Act is almost ready for the full House Armed Services Committee to review. One certainty is that the final dollar total will be smaller than last year. The Pentagon will make a lot of hard decisions in the coming years, but they have data and other tools to help them make those decisions. John Powers is principal at Deloitte and leader of its mergers, acquisitions, and restructuring practice, and Beth McGrath is director of Deloitte's federal practice and former deputy chief management officer at the Defense Department. My guests on Industry Chatter today. Friends, it's terrific to have you in the studio with me. Thank you very much for coming. It's exciting, John, because you've been here before, and I've always enjoyed having you here. This is Beth's first time.
Good to be back. Thanks for having us.
It's great to have you both here. Thank you for being here. John, I want to start with you. As I mentioned, there are tools that are available, and one of the tools that we talked about on previous occasions is performance-based logistics, PBL, and you've done a lot of work in that area. How is that a tool that the Pentagon's leveraging now, and how is it something that they can use more or better or both as they go through the drawdowns that we're seeing moving forward?
PBL is a good example of the Pentagon adopting at least a commercial practice in a good way, and it's a partnership with the vendor, the OEM, around what the Pentagon wants to get out of a certain weapon system. And there are good examples right now. The Pentagon is trending towards a little bit less than 5% of their supply base that would be applicable for this being under this arrangement. But basically, you sign an agreement that says you, the vendor, will provide me XYZ part or system of a certain availability at a certain price. And if you don't, then there's a penalty, or and if you do, there's a reward. And usually what you end up with there is a better price for performance, so the costs go down. But even more importantly, is availability goes up. And I can go into more detail around some of the examples, but what you find is the performance improves while the cost for that performance goes down. That's the way to transform the Pentagon, is programs like that. And we can dive in more if you'd like to take off on that.
Beth, you and I have talked a lot about cost and your attempts to institute a cost culture at the Pentagon. And it sounds like PBL is one important element of that. Is that fair to say?
Yes, absolutely. So the broad transformation optimization conversation really aligns very nicely to the institutional reform mandate that Secretary Hagel has put out there in December, PBL being a very good example. Shared services being another example, but it's really taking a look at the way the department both buys services and executes their mission.
What are the numbers, John? What are some examples of concrete numbers that we can say this was successful, this we could do better with, and so on when it comes to PBL?
Yeah, sure. I'm glad you asked, because this is not in any way cutting edge. This is standard practice and been around for almost a decade. It's just a matter of getting it instantiated in more places. So in about 2005, there was a radar jammer put out by BAE, which critical component to having a jet have proper defensive capabilities. And they worked with the Pentagon to try to work on reducing the cost and increasing the uptime, so to speak, availability. In over 5 years, they were able to show that they could reduce the cost of delivering that to the Pentagon by 30%, which is pretty impressive. The more impressive piece is they increased the availability by 50%. So if you're a warfighter, your ability just went up significantly. And if you're a taxpayer, the cost you just went down significantly. That is not uncommon. If you look at the list of these, and there are hundreds of examples in place today, it's typical. So 30% reduction in cost. Better availability. Now, 50% is impressive, but they're like that as far as performance goes. The key is there's many more systems that this could apply to. It's just a matter of trying to get this into the workforce of the Pentagon and their capability to develop it and work with the vendors on it. It's just a matter of that. That's what the holdback is.
What's the incentive to the vendor, though, to go along with this? Or is it just a case of where DOD has to say, this is just how we're going to do it, and you're going to have to live with it?
There's a lot of incentive for the vendors. In fact, I think the vendors want to go here more than the DOD is ready to go here. The incentive is, one, predictability. So these contracts come – when you sign these, there are usually five or 10-year deals. They come with a very high level of predictability on performance. Second is, this provides – in these contracts, there is prescribed, I'll call it, profitability metrics for the vendor and incentives for better performance. So, if they want to earn or have a better earnings performance on the weapons that they're providing or systems they're providing, excellent opportunity. And then the big incentive is – They know how to change the way they operate and improve performance, but in the way certain things are acquired, there aren't the incentives in the system for them to put the effort and energy into leaning out their processes. So from their perspective, this kind of drives them to optimal business practices, and you will find this in the commercial sector, these kinds of arrangements.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, it's also better for the workforce than the Department of Defense. That's what's often lost here is, so yes, you save money. In this situation, this vendor found it advantageous to work with the depot that was handling this this specific system and actually train them on how to manage a certain part of the supply chain so that the vendor didn't have to do it, save the vendor cost to help them get to the cost target they're trying to hit. So they just put work and capabilities into the Department of Defense, exactly what we want to do with that workforce, make them better, mm-hmm. help them perform better. So in addition to saving costs, you end up with capabilities.
I don't want to pit you against your new colleague, Beth. He said vendors want to go here more than DOD wants to go here. What will change that, do you think, inside the Defense Department?
Yes, thank you for not pitting us against one another. I think what John describes is a scenario where you had very forward-leaning, forward-thinking people, both on the government side and on the commercial side, people who know how to write the contract to ensure that we've got the right incentives, know how to co-locate and partner between the government industry. And I think that is, I would say, much more of an anomaly than I wish it were. But with the rules and regulations that also govern taxpayer dollars and we want to ensure appropriate competition, all those kinds of things that come with it. And so I think it is really understanding how to put scenarios like that in place such that you can achieve both the outcomes and the efficiencies that John describes.
What has to happen workforce-wise to get that group of people where they should be?
Well, I think the incentives now are there. The fiscal pressures, I mean, they are real. And I think that people are looking at different ways better ways to spend their money because they just don't have as much as they used to. And so perhaps before there would not have been a tolerance for this. And now I think there's, people are much more open-minded. And so I think the drive to really think differently about how we execute the business and having, PBL or shared services as part of a solution set that could be pursued, I think that you'll see, more people leaning toward figuring out how to do things differently.
Beth McGrath and John Powers of Deloitte, my guests on Industry Chatter today. I want to push on that a little bit, John, because I keep hearing the word opportunity and have for the last several years along the same line in all kinds of aspects of operation in the federal government. We can get people to do things that they wouldn't have considered doing before, or would have resisted doing before, and we can present it as though, well, we have to do it this way now because of the money situation. At what point do you think it will be fair to say we're now seeing results from these opportunities that we've leveraged? We're seeing significant cost savings. And I'm not just talking about the issues we've covered today. More broadly, we're seeing big cost savings or we're seeing efficiencies of operation that we didn't see before and probably wouldn't have.
I think we're on the verge of seeing them because there are many examples now. We can go into different types. I'll just go back to the one point Beth made on what do we need to do. PBL is a good example on a small scale, and I'll go to others. The problem is it's hard to scale this up in the department because you need a skill set and a capability in the department in order to negotiate, manage, monitor, et cetera. You build that through experience. It's almost you have to do it to do more of it. And we need to change that dynamic by putting in more opportunities to scale into certain experiences to build capability, not just train, but actually do and partner with the department in order to build that capability. That's an example. I think you see it on the organizational alignment that's coming out, meaning the reductions of 20%, lots of consolidation opportunities. I can think of three good examples where the department has issued edicts, memos, that we will realign chain of command, we'll realign organizations. And it is, I think, the driver is we must reduce cost. But the outcome and the way it's described is to improve performance, and that is exactly right. So when I see these memos, I am very encouraged. Because I'm working with some of these organizations and they're asking about, okay, I know I need to put these organizations together. What's our mission going to be? So what you're seeing is organizations talking about how do we align for performance? How do we improve what we deliver? Who is our customer? What does the customer want? And ultimately, again, it gets back to outcomes. Mm-hmm. So what are the outcomes we're trying to achieve for the tax dollar we're trying to spend? So I think we're a couple of years away from seeing this kind of tipping point on many of these operations, and the department really starting to drive to a higher level of performance. Now, I don't know if we're going to save the massive amounts of money. I do think you're going to stop the growth on some of these parts of the Department of Defense, which is critical. It'll put it back into the warfighter, which I think is also a good balance.
Yeah, and I would add to that, by taking all these steps, we'll actually reduce the complexity of the environment and therefore also reduce the redundancies that exist. I mean, some of the concepts that are being pursued, like the joint information environment, I mean, it is to establish a more simplified infrastructure. Yes, there ought to still also be cost savings, but to have a more simplified environment to then execute both your mission and your business, I think will garner all kinds of benefits.
That scratches the surface of the next topic that I want to get into when we come back from the break. My guests are John Powers and Beth McGrath of Deloitte on Industry Chatter, and we'll continue our conversation in just a moment on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. My guests on Industry Chatter today, defense sector leader at Deloitte, John Powers, and Beth McGrath, director of Deloitte's federal practice, former DCMO at the Department of Defense. And Beth, when we broke, we were talking about the workforce inside the Defense Department, and that idea of a smaller workforce that's operationally better on the surface seems like they're counterintuitive. But you made the points before the break about reducing complexity and reducing redundancy. And so the question becomes, is that where a smaller workforce can become operationally better by those two reductions?
I would say yes, and leveraging the information technology applications or systems that you have to do your work probably both better and differently. All of the, I'll say, reforms or transformations or optimizations that we're talking about really is about, doing work differently than you do today, to be much less transactionally focused and more analytically focused. What does the data tell me? Then you have a much different conversation than did my, transaction post properly. I'm actually then looking at, what is the meaning of the data as opposed to the existence of it.
Yeah. Better and differently as two ideas to do the work, though, sounds like a cultural problem as much as an operational problem inside an organization of any size, especially the size of the Defense Department.
Yeah. And I think culture, I've said this for years. When any organization, be it, in the public or private sector is going through any sort of transformation or change, the people really need to come along with it for it to be successful. And it's usually not the IT that's the problem. It's the really, how do I embed the tool within the workforce to demonstrate to them that, this is their friend, and it can actually help them do the work much better as opposed to sort of resisting the whole change. Because in the federal government, many people have been doing what they are doing the way they're doing it for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of, people change as part of that.
So this gets back to the classic question, John, that you and I have discussed before, which is this is as much a leadership issue as it is a policy or a procedures issue. And when you have turnover that by its nature a political operation has, a government operation with political appointees in it has, the culture many times is we're going to be here after these people are gone and we can go back to doing things the way we're doing it. And that seems to me to be the hardest nut to crack when it comes to the leadership element of this.
I would agree. I think, there's some good news in that if you look at what the what Gates and Hagel have both been following through, and I'd say they're senior leaders as well, is they've been on this path in relation, again, I'd say supported by, in some sense, congressional action as well, to reform the DOD, the business of the DOD. So they're driving, I'm going to call it top-down, very large changes that puts the burning platform in place to change. So that's kind of one precondition that's in there. Now that this does get to, we're going to survive. What I've also noticed, again, I'll put it in the good news column, many of the changes that have come down, again, if you read some of the memos, are I need to see a plan within 90 days. Within 180 days, I want to see the concept of operations. And then within 6 months after that, I want the operation to be fully, I want the organization to be fully operational in the new model. So you're seeing mandates or edicts with real follow-up that force people to have to move quicker, which then, again, takes away that opportunity to try to outlast. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of good examples of where you've seen that on the POW, MIA, JPAC, DPMO. Problem has lingered for a while, but the memos are pretty clear. 90 days, bring me a plan. Within this period of time, you're going to actually make some changes. And that's going to make it a lot harder for the organization to collectively resist. And that's another good example of simplification, defragmentation of where the organization sits, enhance the capabilities, deliver a better product. Mm-hmm. Oh, and by the way, when you do that, you will get some cost savings. But the important point is they're focused on performance.
This sounds almost, I mean, correct me if I'm pulling this thread a little bit too hard, but it sounds like this is maybe thinking about these kinds of ideas the same way that Frank Kendall's trying to rethink the requirements process, where you're setting expectations or you're setting your timelines for delivering some kind of deliverable in a different way than you're doing it now. Yeah. Am I on the right
track
there?
Yeah, well, perhaps all roads lead back to acquisition. I'm not sure. but it is certainly defining work in ways that are manageable and doable. Mm-hmm. is certainly a key theme. Certainly in acquisition and the requirements, I think every study says, you know, the requirements part is the part that really needs to be fixed, and then the other pieces will follow. Really understanding what those requirements are, defining them in a way that people all understand, yes, this is what is in the box, and here's what is required to change it, and then delivering something. Mm-hmm. I think we're all suffering from, you know, fatigue in terms of how long it takes to get something deployed. And so if we can chunk the work and actually deliver capability, either the example that John just gave, mm-hmm. and certainly in the acquisition process. In fact, that's what we had tried to do with the IT as well, you know, build in off ramps, deliver modules at a time, and so then you're actually putting a product to market faster.
You each have spoken at various times during our conversation today about data, and the importance of data is something you and I have talked about before, and the ways, Beth, that you tried to use that and push its use further throughout through the Department of Defense. John, I have a note here that says new approaches to data collection analysis can drive the business case for IT innovation in the public sector. How so? And how do you demonstrate that this is going to benefit the organization in some way, either cost savings, better service, or both?
So, again, I think the pressure on the system, so to speak, to simplify and defragment and then reduce costs drive you to innovative thinking, or should drive us to innovative thinking. There's great, and again, the department, and I talked about Beth and work with Beth, and the department has lots of data. And it's like a petabyte a year now we're creating of new data, but not used. I think it's like 0.5% of all the data out there is actually analyzed at any time. And so point is, you have to figure out ways to get into that data. There are examples in the private sector or commercial where you're doing contests around use of data. One of the ones I love, I find this to be hysterical, but it's a good example, is on Kaggle, which is basically a contest site, they put out data sets and ask people to compete. Can you figure out how to build a better algorithm using this data? One of the contests was using a data from Twitter, could you predict if someone was a psychopath or not? I just find it hysterical, so I'm going to be really careful with my Twitter account now.
I think that's a wise idea.
Yeah, but that's an example of personality profiling from publicly available data and doing it in a manner that I believe that contest was for $3,000. So they had people working on this and they'll end up with, I think it was 20 teams. Mm-hmm. Who knows what the teams invested? That's innovative way to contract for it and an innovative, quick solution to look at the data. Apply that to what the department wants to do around putting veterans in jobs. Today it's, hey, what's your MOU? Go on a website. You're a truck driver. Check a box. We'll see how many truck driver jobs out there. I would posit that is necessary but not sufficient. And what if we were to try to use publicly available data, what the person likes, doesn't like, searches, et cetera, link up different personality traits with availability of different types of jobs? We might actually be connecting veterans with careers. And the department will have to get comfortable letting more data out. They have to get comfortable being a little bit more experimental with how people test the data. This is a way to leapfrog some of the things or issues they have, and doing that is very inexpensive. Again, running these contests, building algorithms. We've done this for companies ourselves as an organization. it is a way to get way ahead of analysis. And they have the data to do it. That's the best part about it. You know, there's a lot of data there.
Beth, what is the comfort level, you think, within the building on the data itself and with making that data publicly available and letting people play around with it the way that John's talking about?
So I think there's a balance that needs to be achieved, speaking as the former Fed, especially if it's personal information, about properly protecting that. And so certainly, you know, any competition would still protect data appropriately. But I think John's point is more of there are opportunities that are out there. I would not at all question that the Department of Defense is sitting on a mountain or mountains, you know, of data. The question is, you know, what kind of data could be exposed, frankly, externally, so publicly available, but also just internally, to expose the data more, to use it more, and to use it differently for different purposes. And so I think there's both a public-facing opportunity, but also an internally, you know, I'll say facing, but, you know, data exposure to then, again, figure out, you know, better ways to use the information that they currently have.
Is the arc, do you think, headed in the right direction where people are becoming more comfortable using data and analyzing it and making decisions off of that?
Well, I think yes. As consumers, each of us every day depend on data. And we want it to be accurate and reliable, and we make decisions based on the data that is presented to us on web searches, very significant decisions. And so I think that people are predisposed to, yes, now do that in their sort of day jobs. But I also think within defense, we need to figure out sort of what is the data strategy to then serve it up in a way that can be consumed as we consume it as, you know, I'll say in our private lives, because really there's a whole network that happens behind there to ensure that, you know, the data is normalized and accurate and served up in a way that, you know, it's apples to apples. And so I think there's a lot of work to be done around the data and data strategy. But I also think that's what, you know, part of this joint information environment was also sort of established to do, is to get at the data layer.
I have a whole sheet of other topics and questions I want to talk about, and we're completely out of time, so I'm going to have to ask you both to come back and continue this conversation. It's great to see both of you, John Powers and Beth McGrath of Deloitte, my guests on Industry Chatter, and you can hear our conversation again archived at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon.